Hello, I'm Andrew Kleiman. This is episode 115 of Radio Free Humanity, the Marxist Humanist podcast, coming to you from deep within capitalist society. In this episode's main segment, Gabriel Donnelly and I discuss spurious correlation, specifically why the strong correlation between values and prices is actually spurious correlation. Our discussion is based on chapter 11 of my book, Reclaiming Marx's Capital, and on my parody of the value-price correlation stuff called Christianity versus Alternative Faith Bases. It was recently published in With Sober Senses on Marxist Humanist Initiative's website. But first, Andrew Clard joins Gabriel and me to discuss the Arizona Supreme Court's ruling on April 9 that resurrects an 1864 law that bans almost all abortions in that state. Please visit MarxistHumanistInitiative.org, the website of Marxist Humanist Initiative. You can listen to past episodes of this podcast series there. You can learn more about the issues discussed in them, post comments, and donate to this podcast series. We do need donations, so please donate. Radio Free Humanity is sponsored and hosted by Marxist Humanist Initiative, but the views expressed by hosts and guests are our own. They don't necessarily reflect the views or positions of MHI. On Sunday, April 21, 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time in the U.S., 6 to 8 p.m. British Summer Time, MHI will be holding a Zoom meeting on interpretation that I'll be leading. And on May 5, in the same time slot, it will hold a meeting on Marx's discussion of method in his book, Poverty of Philosophy, led by Francisco. Both meetings are open to the public. If you'd like to attend, please write to MHI, ask to be invited, and say why you're interested in Marxist humanism. It's crucial that you explain your interest because while the meetings are open to people interested in Marxist humanism, I, for one, am glad that MHI does not welcome enemies looking to disrupt and make trouble, like representatives of the so-called Review of Radical Political Economics. To attend the April 21 meeting, you'll have to write in quickly. Next up will be Anne, Gabriel, and me discussing the Arizona abortion ban. Hi, this is Andrew. It's Sunday, April 14, and I'm here with Gabriel Donnelly, my co-host, and Anne Jaclard, Organizational Secretary of Marxist Humanist Initiative. And today we're going to be talking about the decision that came down on Tuesday, April 9, from the Arizona Supreme Court. It resurrected a near total ban on abortions. It's a very old law passed 160 years ago that outlaws all abortions except to save a woman's life. And it makes it a felony to perform an abortion or to help someone obtain one, punishable by 2 to 5 years in prison. So the Arizona Supreme Court ruled that this old law remains in effect and basically supersedes a ban on abortion after 15 weeks that Arizona passed 2 years ago. The decision is set to go into effect on April 23, but Arizona's Attorney General, who's a Democrat, has promised not to enforce this law. So, Anne, what do you think about this decision?
I think it's a terrible decision. It's a disaster for women, but so have the other decisions that have come down since Roe versus Wade was overturned 2 years ago. The gist of all these decisions is that women have no bodily autonomy. Women have no legal rights to run their physical lives the way they want to run them, that the state can intervene and take away their rights. And it doesn't matter if women die from this. We've been hearing horror stories about this in the news. It's an utter disgrace.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything. This is completely misogynistic court decision, and it's following from the misogynistic far right Supreme Court Dobbs decision. It's bringing us back to 1864 in terms of women's rights in this country, and it's something we should all feel deeply ashamed of.
Yeah, we kind of live in a country in which corporations are people and fetuses are people, but women aren't people.
Okay, these latest cases and all the cases that have upheld draconian state laws since Dobbs have come about because the judiciary has moved to the right and the Republicans are so right wing that they will only appoint right wingers to the courts. And so the courts have gotten exceedingly reactionary. It has to do with the Trump agenda, in which he wants and needs to keep the evangelical vote. And so he's moving the courts further and further to the right on these issues. What they're demolishing bit by bit is the 14th Amendment. And that can affect more than abortion rights. It can affect all kinds of individual rights. And we're in for more trouble if we don't get rid of these folks, which we better do.
People are rightfully mortified and outraged, and women within Arizona are mobilizing to fight this, and it seems like there's going to be an attempt to get a ballot initiative on the ballot in Arizona this upcoming election. And outside of the state of Arizona, across the country, in states where this might happen, or even in quote-unquote safe states, people are also, you know, mobilized to fight for women's rights on this. And that is encouraging. We need to act when things like this happen. But, you know, I've seen some championing of, oh, look, the Republicans are shooting themselves in the foot again by going after abortion. And that's good for Joe Biden. Arizona's an important state. It probably will help him. But that's, I think that's the wrong way to talk about this, because this is, it's just awful on its own. France made abortion access a constitutionally protected right. And meanwhile, here in America, you know, we're this backwards on this fundamental issue.
Yes, this is terrible. On the other hand, you know, the fight is not over. And people are really incensed, even in red states. It's harder to hold two opposites in one's, you know, head than just to say, here is the one thing to focus on. But I think we need to do both, because if we don't accentuate the opportunities that we still have to win back freedoms, we can get very despondent. And there are opportunities out there, you know, as early as these upcoming elections.
Something like 70% of the voting age population is in favor of abortion rights. So it seems that the Republicans are shooting themselves in the foot. On the other hand, they have reason to do what they're doing. They're appealing to a certain sector of Trump-supporting right-wingers, and it's a very dangerous situation. We may have a civil war, not between women and men, because a lot of men are also for abortion rights, but between the Trumpites and the sane people.
Most people are in favor of abortion, but, you know, Republicans have to appease these very extreme anti-abortion fringe elements within their rank and file. And that leads them to enact these things that are actually broadly unpopular outside of that fringe.
Well, they are unpopular, but I don't know that I'd call them fringe, because 30% of the country following Trump and doing whatever he says.
Right. The problem is they don't know what to say. Maybe the whole party will follow Trump, but Trump doesn't have a consistent line because of the corner into which they've painted themselves, you know, by being beholden to the Christian right, but also trying to win elections. Trump is, no, I'm not going to sign a nationwide abortion law, leaving it to the states. This is all working out well. Arizona's got to rescind what it just did. They're facing the problem of their own positions being internally contradictory because they're trying to have it both ways, kowtowing to the Christian right, but also having a chance to win an election without stealing it.
What's really going on in the country is there are two camps now. Women are not alone in the camp of people who think we should have civil rights and we should have rights to our bodily autonomy and we should have individual control over our lives. There's a lot of people like that, and we're not going away. The far right has picked a bad subject to lay down its body on because other people are not going along with it. So I think we'll see, I hope we'll see some trashing of the Republicans in the next election, and that the state legislatures will be passing laws and amendments to guarantee abortion rights instead of destroy them.
We are already seeing the Trumpists and Trump himself scramble on this and try to moderate their position on it. We're seeing their desperation because they recognize how unpopular this is, but the damage is done.
You show that their empirical results actually do not support Marx because the correlations are spurious. But let's assume, for the sake of argument, the correlations were not spurious. Would strong value price correlations then support Marx's theory?
No, they definitely wouldn't. Marx explicitly rejected their main claim. What they claim is that differences between values and prices are random. They're not systematic differences. Marx said exactly the opposite.
Hello, it is April the 11th, 2024. I'm Gabriel Donnelly, and I'm here, as always, with co-host Andrew Kleiman. And today we're going to be talking about Chapter 11 of Andrew's 2007 book, Reclaiming Marx's Capital, and also an additional parody, Christianity versus Alternative Faith Bases, which Andrew hopes to publish in Marxist Humanist Initiative's publication with Sober Senses soon. How are you doing today, Andrew?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing well. I'm glad to be here. We have some dense material to dig into together today, but I think it should be fun and informative.
Yeah, fun and informative.
So I think we should jump right into it. Can you tell us what exactly is spurious correlation?
Yeah, you've got two variables and they're correlated. They're statistically associated with each other. They move up and down together or in opposite directions. That's a correlation. If the correlation disappears or is lowered a whole lot, when you control for the influence of some third variable, which is a so-called hidden variable, then that correlation is called spurious. I'll give an example in a moment. But let me just say that the word spurious is kind of misleading because the correlation is a statistical fact. You're not like making up the number. But the point is that there seems to be a cause and effect relation between the original two variables. But when the correlation is spurious, that cause and effect relation is in fact what's spurious. There is a statistical association of the two variables, but variations in the third hidden variable are driving the movements of both of the other two original variables. One classic case that I like a lot to explain this has to do with fires. And you've got the number of firefighters who are at the scene of a fire, and you've got the amount of damage that's done by the fire. And so there's a correlation where you got more firefighters, you got more damage by the fire. That's a spurious correlation because it's not that the firefighters are causing the damage and it's not that the damage is giving birth to the firefighters. There's a statistical correlation, but it's spurious because neither of those variables is causing the other. What's actually going on is that a third variable, a hidden variable, the size of the fire, is driving the movements of both the number of firefighters and the extent of the damage. Where you've got a big fire, a lot of firefighters come to the scene, and where you got a big fire, it does a lot of damage. So there's a correlation, you can measure it. Statistically, it exists, but it doesn't explain, there is no causal relationship between the firefighters and the damage.
As you mentioned, spurious is a little misleading because it doesn't not exist, right? But if we were just looking at those two data points,
yeah,
I think, geez, are these firefighters causing this damage? There's so many firefighters, there's such damage, but we're missing this third data point that's crucial to clarifying what's really going on.
Yeah, absolutely. What's really spurious is not the correlation, but any suggestion of a cause and effect relationship between the two original variables.
So to get right to the heart of the matter, why do you say that the correlations between value and price are spurious?
Okay, first of all, these are correlations between the value and the price of different industries' total annual output. The value and the price of the total output of, let's say, wholesale trade industry, of the total output of the computer and electronics product industry, they're not correlations between prices and values in the normal sense, between the values and the prices of individual items. The price of an apple and the value of an apple, or the price and the value of a coat. This is very much like the fire example, because it's another case in which the size is the hidden third variable, just like the firefighters and the damage. The value and price of total output are both going to be large when you've got a large industry, and they're both going to be small when you got a small industry. So it's the size of the industry that's driving both the value of its total output and the price of its total output. And it turns out that that is all that is going on. Once we control for variations in the size of the industry, as measured by the total cost incurred in producing the total output, then there's no longer any association between values and prices. So the value-price correlation is spurious because it's completely accounted for by the introduction of this third variable, size, as measured by cost.
Just like in the case of the size of the fire. As you're saying, you show, I think, pretty conclusively that the correlation between value and price is spurious. And a lot of people over the decades have published, quote unquote, empirical studies on price-value correlations. Paul Cockshott, Alan Cottrell, Dave Zachariah, Alejandro Valle-Baeza, Lefteris Soulfidis, and Thanasis Maniatis, and a number of others. Who started this cottage industry and why?
In the 1970s, there was a resurgence of allegations that Marx's value theory is internally inconsistent. These allegations principally came from people on the left, known as Schroffians or neo-Ricardians. Now, eventually, the temporal single system interpretation of Marx's value theory came along, and it interprets Marx's theory in a way that eliminates the appearance of inconsistency. But prior to the temporal single system interpretation coming along, people tried to argue against the allegations of inconsistency, and they produced arguments that just really didn't do the job. And one of these people was Anwar Sheikh, economist at the New School for Social Research in New York. He realized that his arguments actually didn't do the job. Eventually, he gave that up. And so he decided to do something else. He decided to sidestep the issues of interpretation. He decided to just abandon the realm of theory here entirely. And he said, I'm going to defend the labor theory of value basically by throwing statistics at a theoretical problem. And other people had similar ideas. For instance, a couple of mathematicians Emmanuel Farjoun, and Moshe Machover. Okay, so what was the theoretical problem that they were sidestepping? This was an alleged inconsistency in Marx's theory, and specifically it was the discrepancy between the total price and total value produced in the economy as a whole. And along with that, the discrepancy between the total profit in the economy as a whole and total surplus value. So why is that a problem? Well, it's the opposite of what Marx said. Marx recognized that price of an apple is not going to equal the value of an apple. The price of a coat is not going to equal the value of a coat, etc. But Marx said, okay, when you look at the economy as a whole, the total price equals the total value. And the total profit in the economy as a whole equals the total surplus value. So in the aggregate, value does still determine price. And the surplus value that's created by workers' labor, that is the exclusive source of profit. This is what Marx claimed. The law of value continues to hold as a law pertaining to the total economy. But the Neo-Ricardians, Schroffians, they alleged that that argument was logically inconsistent. And Anwar Sheikh is agreeing with them. He is not answering them theoretically, but he says total value doesn't equal total price, total profit doesn't equal total surplus value. Big deal. Prices and values are close, and they're strongly correlated. So who cares whether the numbers add up or not? It's just like if physicists had told Einstein, we don't need your fancy German Hegelian theory of relativity. Newton's theory works well enough. It's close. Let's get on with business. It's the same kind of response.
Right. Before you wrote your parody on the value-price correlation, Christianity versus alternative faith basis, you'd already published several papers on the spurious character of the correlations, and you summarized your main findings and arguments in the aforementioned Chapter 11 of Reclaiming Marx's Capital. So why did you follow all this work up with a parody that compares their version of the labor theory of value, this empiricist, quote-unquote, defense, to a Christianity theory of income? You made your case well enough already. Why move to satire?
Well, yeah. Theoretically, I'd made the case well enough, for sure. I'd shown that the value-price correlations are spurious, full stop. But my demonstrations were not enough to put an end to the bogus empirical defense of the so-called labor theory of value. Anwar Sheikh did not confess. People who followed in his tracks, Cockshott and Cottrell, Zachariah, etc., 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 they kept churning out spurious value-price correlations that were hoodwinking people. So I felt like I had to continue the battle. I had an obligation to tell people what's the real deal. So that's one reason for the parody. And the other is that my previous demonstrations would be hard to understand if you didn't have the needed background in statistics. So what I wanted to do was to show in a way that everybody can immediately grasp how bogus and silly the value-price correlation stuff is. And it's exactly like saying that Christianity is the dominant determinant of income because in states with a lot of Christians, the total state income is high. Lots of Christians, big state income. And in states with fewer Christians, the total state income is lower. Nobody's going to fall for that. It's obvious that the size of the state, as measured by the state's population, the population of the state, that's the third hidden variable here. In large states, you got a lot of people. That's why you got a lot of Christians, and that's why you got large income. In small states, without so many people, you got many fewer Christians, and you got a much smaller income. And that's all that's going on. So I used actual statistics in this parody to show that, and it's point by point, term by term, analogous to the value price correlation stuff.
Yeah, and when the listeners get a chance to read it, which I encourage them all to, the funny thing about it is, and it is funny, it's cheeky, it's clearly being cheeky, but it's so clear that there is that third variable out there. But as Andrew said, there's real statistics in here. But it's such a ridiculous argument that you're channeling your Jonathan Swift, I suppose. But no baby eating in this one.
Yeah, a modest correlation or something.
The bad actors, in terms of this spurious correlation, they're not the only ones at fault. I'm sure there are a bunch of listeners out there who feel similarly. Math is something for other people to do. That's something for other people to look closer at. I don't get it. I can't wrap my head around it. I don't need to think about this. Somebody has proved it empirically. Great job. That's just not cutting it. You're starting with what you want to be the conclusion, and you're working backwards, and you're sort of glancing and saying, yeah, that looks legit to me. Take a little time, actually look this stuff over, and don't let your graphophobia lead you to being led around by the nose. That's just a little PSA.
I totally agree with you. I think that's quite right. People have to do the work of separating the wheat from the chaff. In a field like this, everybody is trying to run some line on you. The only thing that you can trust is human reason. And you can't trust other people to give you human reason. You have to supply it yourself.
Yeah. Again, I want to ask a question that kind of jumps back. Can you walk us through how you at first initially got interested in this issue of spurious value price correlations?
Yeah, I got tuned into it through Alan Freeman. I think it was 1996, and we were both at a conference where Anwar Sheikh was there and Paul Cockshott, and I think Alan Cottrell was there. And Alan Freeman says there's a likely to be a spurious correlation problem here. And he was very concerned about that this project of correlating the value and the prices of the industry output, he was very concerned about the damage that it could do to the reputation of Marxian theory. I remember him saying to me, what if the right-wingers were to learn about what these people were doing? What if mainstream economists generally took notice of this literature? They would have a field day with it. And who would that harm? It would harm all of us, not just Sheikh and Cockshott and Cottrell and Ochoa and all of those people. It would harm Marxian theory generally if they were able to say, we know what you guys are doing and it's totally bogus. But at the time, Alan's telling me that this is likely to be spurious correlation. I didn't know what he was talking about because I hadn't paid any attention to this value price correlation stuff. The reason I hadn't paid any attention to it is because it's theoretically irrelevant. But when Alan Freeman draws my attention to the spurious correlation issue, then I began to look at their stuff more closely.
Can I ask you if I'm understanding you correctly that if this conference, Alan Freeman indicated to you that this issue is so blatant that if a mainstream economist who's not trying to prove a particular strand of Marxian ideology looks at it, it will immediately leap out to them.
Yeah, if they understand what is being measured, even if they don't know the theory underlying it, they would say, why are you making a mountain out of something that's obvious where you got a big industry? Yeah, this measure of price is going to be real high. The other measure of price that you call value, that's going to be high. Small industry, just the opposite. That's what anybody who knew what they were doing at all, even without any theoretical background, would immediately say. This is too obvious to ever publish a paper on.
Yeah, and it's almost like they're taking advantage of the fact that Marxist thought is a marginalized one. So fringe ideas that are really fringe and not sound can have a purchase in this sphere that, if it was ever to break out of the bubble, would be embarrassing. That's really shocking to me, actually.
That's exactly how it is.
Alan Freeman had already drawn attention to the fact that the correlations were spurious. What's pulling you to really get involved?
I got involved for a few reasons. One is that Alan convinced me that it is important to battle this stuff because the reputation of Marxian theory is on the line. And the second reason is Alan Freeman calls my attention to it. What took place in the conference got published as a book collection. There was a very short comment from him, and then it sat there. It didn't get the attention it deserved. So the battle has to continue to draw attention to this. But the biggest reason I got involved is I started to think and think and think about the spurious correlation problem. And the issue was industry size. We have to control for its influence because that is likely to be causing spurious correlation. Well, how do I control for the influence of industry size? I finally figured out a way to do that. And that was a big deal because that enables me to do more than just warn that the correlations are probably spurious. I can now control for the influence of industry size and actually test whether the correlations are spurious, as they turn out to be.
Before 1996, this conference, what's the overall consensus towards this so-called empirical evidence, strongly correlating price and value?
They're not paying attention that closely and they get fooled. Or maybe they were in on the con, but I kind of doubt that. For instance, Duncan Foley, very well-known economist, Sheikh's colleague at the New School, he wrote, quote, "Since replicable empirical regularities are rather rare in economics, the strong evidence these studies offer for a widespread coherence between embodied labor coefficients, in other words, values, prices of production, and market prices is of indubitable scientific interest." Close quote. So he fell for it or whatever, I don't know. Another person, Meghnad Desai, an economist who also was made a British lord, wrote that the value price correlation is, quote, "a robust empirical result," close quote, and that, quote, "the empirical results support Marx," close quote. These are some big name people, published books, people follow them. I think that they just didn't look at the stuff with the care that you need to discover why it's a spurious correlation that's going on.
Yeah, it's like a magic trick here. You look at the wrong thing and you have to want to be fooled.
Yeah, there's definitely misdirection by calling this the correlation between price and value. Because again, when people say price and value, that leads you to think the price and value of individual items.
You show that their empirical results actually do not support Marx because, as we've been repeatedly discussing, the correlations are spurious. But let's assume, for the sake of argument, the correlations were not spurious. Would strong value price correlations then support Marx's theory?
No, they definitely wouldn't. And that's a really important point. And actually, early on, when Sheikh was first launching this project, he admitted this. I'm going to quote what he says. Quote, "It is worth recalling that neither Marx nor Ricardo argue that cross-sectional variations are negligible. Indeed, they both emphasize that at any time, prices of production may significantly differ from values," close quote. In other words, values and prices that are close in some sense are not evidence in favor of Marx for a very simple reason. He didn't claim that they're close. I think Sheikh may have been arm twisted into admitting this. It's not something that the spurious correlators emphasize a lot, to put it mildly. But they're all aware of this. And in fact, Marx explicitly rejected their main claim. What they claim is that differences between values and prices are random. They're not systematic differences. And what that implies, among other things, is that the differences between surplus value and profit, they're also random and not systematic. Marx said exactly the opposite. Right there in volume one of Capital, it's in chapter 11 in English edition. Quote, "Everyone knows that a cotton spinner who employs much constant capital and little variable capital does not, on account of this, pocket less profit or surplus value than a baker who sets in motion relatively much variable capital and little constant capital." You need to know some of the terminology, variable capital, constant capital, so forth. But what Marx is saying is there is a systematic difference between industry level surplus value and industry level profit. That's directly the opposite of Sheikh and Eduardo Ochoa and Paul Cockshott and Alan Cottrell and Dave Zachariah and all the rest of them. Even if there weren't spurious correlation going on, the correlations would not confirm Marx's value theory. And conversely, the fact that once you control for size, industry level values and prices are not correlated, that doesn't disconfirm Marx's theory, because his theory has nothing to do with prices and values of individual commodities. Marx's defense of the law of value has to do with aggregate economy-wide equalities. The total price of all output in the economy equals the total value. Total profit in the economy as a whole equals the total surplus value. And the price rate of profit of the total economy equals the value rate of profit of the total economy. That's where he's saying that the law of value is confirmed. And he explicitly said that price value difference in individual industries have no bearing on the validity of the law of value.
So you just read out a couple quotations there, and I think in the spirit of the moment, I'd like to read out a quote from you. It leapt out to me in your parody. You wrote that these people are pursuing a scientistic and pseudoscientific project that is hostile to theory in general and dismissive of Marx's value theory in particular, unquote. I think it's clear from what we've already covered today that the project is pseudoscientific and hostile to Marx's value theory. Why do you say it's scientistic and hostile to theory more generally?
Yeah, I actually don't mean those as two different things. I think it's scientistic because it's hostile to theory. These people are overly enamored with empirical evidence. I think empirical evidence is hugely important, but it's important where it's applicable. It doesn't get rid of theoretical difficulties, but these people pretend that they can make theoretical difficulties disappear by throwing data at them. In this case, throwing spurious correlation data at them. So they're pretending that the theoretical problems don't matter and that they don't need to be solved. Given their misinterpretation of Marxian theory, total price and total value aren't equal, and total profit doesn't equal total surplus value. Let's say profit is bigger than surplus value in the economy as a whole. Well, where does the extra profit come from? That's a theoretical problem, and it demands a theoretical explanation, and they don't provide that. And if there's this extra profit over and above the surplus value, then it's obvious. Marx's value theory can be chucked out the window. His exploitation theory of profit, that all profit comes from, you know, extracting surplus labor from workers, that goes right out the window. And what alternative do these spurious correlators provide? None whatsoever. So there's a certain hostility to theory that you can detect here. They pretend that they can sweep theoretical problems under the rug, avoid grappling with them by throwing statistics at them, saying that values and prices are close. But close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades, and maybe engineering. But it doesn't count in physics, it doesn't count in accounting, and it doesn't count in economic theory. Physicists don't say, oh, we don't need this theory of relativity, Newton's theory is close enough. But if that were the state of physics, we'd be in really bad shape. Real physicists don't think like that.
So to get back to your book, you single out two problems that plague the value-price correlations, the aggregation problem and the tautological correlation problem. Can you explain more for me and for the listeners? What are these problems? Are they distinct problems from the problem that the correlations are spurious because the variations in industry size causing industry's total value and total price to vary together, or are they part of the same problem?
Okay, one is, one isn't. The aggregation problem is part of the size problem. What I was pointing out in the chapter is that the variations in industry sizes that produce the spurious correlations, these variations in industry sizes are not brute facts. These variations in industry size are created by statisticians because they classify industries in one way instead of another way. In particular, government statisticians create variations in industry size that aren't even there in the raw data, when they aggregate many smaller industries into one. And you can actually aggregate even further, though, in a way that evens out the industry sizes and torpedoes the spurious correlations. I'm writing an article now that does just that with Eduardo Ochoa's data. He was a graduate student of Shake's, who basically co-founded this whole project. Ochoa wrote a dissertation on the value price correlation stuff about 40 years ago. And I've used his data for 1947 and for 1987. And by aggregating his 71 industries into 8 industries, I've made the correlations disappear. No controlling for size or anything other than just taking 71 industries and aggregating some of them together, the correlations disappear. Now, the tautological correlation problem arises when you measure the correlation between two things that share a significant component. The fact that there's a correlation isn't meaningful because what you're measuring is simply that this common component is perfectly correlated with itself. For instance, in the case that we're talking about here, cost of total output is the main component of the price of total output, and the cost of total output is also the main component of the value of total output. So when you look at the correlation between the value and the price, you're mostly capturing the correlation of cost with cost. You're going to get very large correlations just because you got the same thing in one column that you got in the other column. I'll give you another example. I looked at gross domestic product, GDP, and gross national income for 41 countries in the Western Hemisphere in 2015. The correlation between GDP and GNI was near perfect, 0.97. The maximum possible is 1. But this 0.97 is just meaningless, since the main component of GDP and GNI is one and the same thing, namely income that's generated domestically and received domestically. People would just laugh in your face. No real journal would think of publishing a paper that shows GDP and GNI are strongly correlated. It's obvious, and because it's obvious, it's not meaningful. It's the same thing being correlated with itself on both sides, basically. But the exact same kind of thing keeps being published and taken seriously in some quarters when it comes to values and prices, or at least they pretend that they're taking it seriously.
So there's been responses to your work on this question. Emilio Diaz and Ruben Osana responded to your demonstrations that the correlations are spurious, which you've been talking about the whole episode. They argued that, in effect, you had only shown that industry-level cost is strongly correlated with industry-level total value and total price. In their view, you haven't shown that the variations in cost cause the variations in industry-level total value and total price. It could be that variations in total value cause the variations in cost and total price. And it could be that variations in total price cause the variations in cost and total value. So to this, Andrew, what's your response?
Yeah, they're wrong. The problem that they are posing here was solved back in 1954 by Herbert Simon. And actually, Diaz and Osuna cite Herbert Simon's paper, but they didn't understand it at all. And Simon's solution is actually very simple, and it's obviously correct. To try to understand what's going on here, let's take the firefighter and fire damage example. What we say is that the size of the fire is the cause of the number of firefighters at the scene, and the size of the fire is the cause of the extent of fire damage. But the statistics alone don't tell us that. The statistics just measure correlation, not causation. So it could be, you know, if you were Diaz and Osuna, that the extent of the damage causes the size of the fire. The more the damage is, that's going to make the fire bigger. And it could be that the extent of the damage brings firefighters to the scene. That's basically what Diaz and Osuna are arguing. But it's absurd, because we know that causes precede effects. What happens later can't be the cause of what happens earlier. And that was Simon's point. His point is, we have the information from the correlations, but we have pre-existing information regarding what comes first and what comes second. First, there's a fire. Then there's damage and firefighters at the scene. But because there's first a fire, it's not going to be that the damage causes the fire or the firefighters are causing the fire. And because we know that the fire comes first, then the damage and the firefighters, we not only have a correlation, we have a cause-effect explanation as well. The size of the fire is the cause of the other two things. And in exactly the same way, we know that businesses incur costs before they produce the output that has a certain value and a certain price. Okay? And what comes before causes what comes after, not vice versa. So we know that variations in cost cause the variations in industry level total value and total price, not the value causing cost and price, and not the price causing cost and value. It's really that simple.
Thank you for that. Let's move on to some more attempted refutations of your argument. Paul Cockshott and Trell and their crew have denied that the value-price correlations are spurious. Cockshott and Cottrell argued that the value-price correlations aren't spurious because the correlation between prices and values in terms of labor content are stronger than the correlation between prices and volumes in terms of electricity content, and stronger than the correlation between prices and values in terms of oil content, and so on. If the correlations between labor content values and prices are essentially spurious, then we could get equally good results using something other than labor content as the quote-unquote basis of value. But that's not the case. I'm curious to hear what your response is to that argument, Andrew.
This is complete humbug, to use one of Anwar Sheikh's favorite words. And one of the main things I wanted to do in my parody is ridicule this argument into oblivion. So, like you say, the Cockshott and Cottrell line is, if the correlations between labor values and prices were spurious, we could get equally good results with a different value basis. But we can't, so the correlations aren't spurious. That's their line. Let's apply the same argument to the correlation between the number of Christians in a state and the state's total income. And then you see how the argument works. If the correlations between Christianity and income were spurious, we could get equally good results using a different basis of faith, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, but we can't. And in fact, I show in my parody using real data that we can't. The correlation between statewide income and the number of Christians is much stronger than the correlations between statewide income and the number of Jews, Muslims, and Buddhists. So according to Cockshott and Cottrell, the correlation between Christianity and income isn't spurious. It does better than correlation between income and Jews, income and Muslims, income and Buddhists. So it's not spurious. It really is the case that Christianity is the dominant determinant of income. And I have a bridge in Brooklyn you may be interested in buying.
Not looking for a bridge at the moment, Andrew, but I appreciate the offer.
Okay. What's wrong with this alternative value basis argument is that it has absolutely nothing to do with the definition of spurious correlation. According to the definition, if a correlation between two variables disappears, or if it's lowered substantially once we control for the influence of some third variable, then the correlation is spurious. This alternative value basis nonsense simply ignores the issue of whether a third variable is the cause of the other two. There's no third variable even mentioned. So it's a bait and switch. All it is a bait and switch.
Cockshott and Cottrell and their associates have also claimed that industry size is not a hidden third variable that produces spurious correlation between values and prices, because the total value and the total price of industry's outputs are themselves measures of industry size. They say that what they're measuring is how closely related these two measures of size are. So what's your response to this dismissal of the third variable?
Yeah, well, they're trying to save face. It's not how they presented what they were doing before the spurious correlation problem was exposed. Keep in mind that they chose to refer to the correlations as correlations between values and prices, not correlations between the total value of industry's output and the total price of industry's output. In any case, the argument doesn't hold any water because of the aggregation problem. The size of industries, that's not a brute fact, and therefore the value of the correlation coefficient is not a brute fact. It's an artifact of how statisticians choose to aggregate industries. And since cost is the main component of both the value and the price of things, it's not surprising and it's not important at all that the total value and the total prices of industries' outputs are strongly correlated. It just reflects the tautological correlation of cost with itself.
So in addition to the correlation data, these people will also produce numbers that show that deviations between industry-level total value and industry-level total price are relatively small, on average only about 10-20%, sometimes even less. What do you think of this evidence?
First of all, again, theoretically, it is not important. As I quoted earlier, way back when, Anwar Sheikh admitted this, quote, "Neither Marx nor Ricardo argue that cross-sectional variations between values and prices are negligible." Secondly, the small deviations simply reflect the fact that profit margins are small. If the profit margins were bigger, the deviations between value and price would be bigger. And aggregation is again an issue here because the aggregation of industries makes the measured deviations smaller. When you take several small industries and you aggregate them into one larger one, the deviations between them tend to cancel out. So the size of the deviations is another thing that's partly, you know, an artifact of how the statisticians deal with the raw data. It's not a brute fact. But the most important thing is that once we control for differences in costs, prices and values are not close in the sense that Sheikh, Cockshott, and Cottrell, or Cho, or the rest of them, they're not close in the sense that these people require. If prices and values were close because after controlling for cost, it was still the case that prices are high where values are high and prices are low where values are low. If they were close in that sense, that would be a meaningful result. It would confirm their prediction or tend to confirm it. But values and prices are not close in that sense.
I want to encourage our listeners, if they don't have a copy of Reclaiming Marx's Capital, to purchase one and to read your parody. I also want to put out another message. It's a theme that we've hit on again and again in Radio Free Humanity, and we hit on in this episode, which is don't be led by the nose, by numbers and statistics and confirmation bias, hearing what you want to hear, confirmation of something that you think you want to hear. This stuff is serious work. It takes sitting down, using your head. And I understand that that takes a lot of time and we're all very busy people, but it's worthwhile to put in the work. And so if you're still wondering about this, I encourage our listeners to keep continuing the reading and write into us and comment with any questions and further dialogue on this.
In terms of doing the work and we're busy people, W.K. Clifford, who wrote The Ethics of Belief, said it really well. He says, yeah, you know, people say I'm busy. I don't have time to look at this for myself. He says, fine, I understand. But why are you taking the time to believe something that you haven't checked out? If you're too busy to check it out, you should also be too busy to believe it. And that's all. Thank you so much.
I had a lot of fun with this.
You've been listening to Gabriel Donnelly and me discussing spurious value-price correlations. Please visit MHI's website, MarxistHumanistInitiative.org, to listen to other episodes, to learn more about the issues we discuss, to post comments, and to donate to this podcast series. Let me announce again that MHI will be holding Zoom meetings on interpretation on April 21 and on Marx's discussion of method in his Poverty of Philosophy on May 5, both at 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time in the U.S., 6 to 8 p.m. British Summer Time. They're open to the public. If you'd like to attend, please write to MHI, ask to be invited, and explain why you're interested in Marxist humanism. This has been episode 115 of Radio Free Humanity, the Marxist Humanist Podcast, coming to you from deep within capitalist society. Thanks for listening. Bye now.